Hello, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's Today's Topics in Health Disparities. I'm Kara James, the Foundation's Senior Policy Analyst on Race, Ethnicity, and Healthcare. Today's Topics is a series of conversations that addresses issues relating to health and healthcare disparities in the U.S. Today's focus, Are Healthcare Disparities Back on the National Agenda, comes on the heels of an historic election. In addition to the election of the first black president, Democrats have increased their majority in both the House and the Senate. It also comes in the midst of a serious economic crisis. Our conversation today will cover what an Obama presidency and the heavily Democratic Congress might mean for health disparities, what types of policies or initiatives we could expect to see, how these initiatives might fit into a larger health reform conversation, and where the elimination of health disparities might rank on the priority list of Congress and the Obama administration. We welcome your questions, so feel free to email us. The address is ask@kaisernetwork.org. Our panel today includes three distinguished guests whose bios are available on our website. In our studio, we have Dr. Peter Buck, former senior advisor for the Office of the Administrator at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and an associate attending physician at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Next to him is Dr. Brian Smedley, Vice President of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies and the Director of the Center's Health Policy Institute. And joining us by telephone is Representative Ilda Solis of California, who is a member of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce and the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus's Health and Environmental Task Force. I want to thank you all for joining us. Representative Solis, I'd like to start with you. You've been someone who's championed health disparities as an issue in Congress during your time there. Do you think health disparities are back on the agenda? I think we're having some technical difficulties, so I'll start with you, Dr. Bach. Do you think health disparities are back on the agenda?
I think to some extent the health disparities have remained on the national agenda. And one of the challenges that the incoming Congress will face and the president-elect will face is how to layer in activities that are fundamentally reform-oriented and on the healthcare side in a way that health disparities are directly addressed and directly measured. And there will be challenges ahead in doing that. Several of the proposals in place for major healthcare reform, whether they're going to come from the president-elect in the White House or from some of the authorizing committees of Medicare, focus on things like expanding insurance access, altering the look and feel, if you will, of the interface between patients and doctors, such as the broader implementation of health information technologies. And a lot of those sorts of strategies, be it the broadening of the insurance pool or the implementations of HIT, have the potential to greatly affect those who are most poorly served right now by our healthcare system, who are, on average, members of minority groups. Whether or not there is a focus with disparities sort of being carved out as a separate agenda at the federal level or even within the states in a more emphatic way, let's say, under this administration than it has been under the previous or the current administration, I think remains an open question. And I'm not sure strategically what's best either on the political side or, frankly, what's best on the healthcare side in terms of getting sort of the best health gains we can amongst the people who have been most poorly served.
Okay. And what about you, Brian? Do you think that they're back on the national agenda?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to start with the understanding that health disparities are as old as this nation, 350 years of health disparities. Undoubtedly, they were worse closer to the founding of this country. Things have been getting better, as the data indicate. So I don't know that health disparities are back on the agenda, but I think that there's a growing chorus of voices to address health disparities. And I think that it's important that the administration and Congress understand that in order to really fully realize the benefits of a stimulus package and get our economy back on track, we have to ensure that everybody is able to fully participate in our economic recovery. And this includes people of color who unfortunately are disproportionately less able to take advantage of economic opportunities because of poor health status. So I think the message that I'd like to convey, and that I know a lot of other folks want to convey, is that it's going to be very difficult to have a full recovery without attending to health disparities.
Okay. So we are definitely going to talk about the economic recovery, but before we move to that, I sort of want to go back to this point of, is it a standalone issue, or is this something that, you know, from a strategic standpoint, we want to do little by little? And so I guess I want to get your sense of, do you think this might be something that would become a major strategic reform like we saw in 2000 that led to the creation of the National Center for Minority Health and Health Disparities and the National Healthcare Disparities Report? Or do you think that this would be something that, you know, kind of, as you were saying, would be infused into some of the other areas and reforms that are going on?
I think for me, you know, it's hard, like I said before, it's a little hard to predict which way it will go.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in terms of getting the gains that we would like to see, it you know, it's very important to recognize, along with, you know, Brian's points, which are undoubtedly correct, that we have a general healthcare quality problem in this country. Healthcare not only costs too much, which we broadly accepted, we not only have huge populations of uninsured, unlike any other developing country, but we also serve quite poorly those who are fully covered. And I think, you know, it would be nice to have more research and more study on this particular issue, but the point I'm about to make, but I think the evidence is starting to suggest or support strongly the notion that the most effective quality improvement happens in places where quality is the lowest in terms of sort of dollar spend. Part of it is a so-called ceiling effect, that you can't really drive up the performance of high-performing institutions, but it's also just sort of, it's the low-hanging fruit, if you will, are more abundant in sort of low-performing settings. And so it seems to me that we need not, although I'm comfortable going down a direction where we do separate healthcare quality improvement from disparities reduction, but we need not separate them, because disparities reduction, disparities, if you will, emerge largely because of concentrated areas of poor quality care, low resource areas, low provider competency areas, low health literacy areas. These things tend to cluster in geographic ways. And those are the places that I believe, even just in terms of an efficiency and stimulus setting, if you will, that dollars spent will yield the greatest health gains compared to, let's say, a high-performing place that's relatively wealthy and where the non-minority populations tend to dominate. And so I don't, you know, it would be interesting to forecast whether or not we'll have increasing numbers of, let's say, centers of, you know, minority health centers, or bundle things into the civil rights office and other structural changes. But, you know, irregardless of how it looks in terms of a table of organization, I think the greatest gains are to be had by being sort of very focused on these underserved populations, irrespective at some level of skin color or ethnic background. But, you know, you may have a different view of it, so.
Well, I think what you've said is largely right. There are some structural and systemic issues, quality, cost, coverage, that need to be addressed because everybody will benefit. But clearly there are some issues that are also particular to populations of color that we also need to address. One of the fears that I have as we talk about the need to eliminate disparities is that some folks see these as being issues for those folks over there. And that's absolutely wrong. Disparities affect all of us. Disparities contribute to high costs for all of us. They contribute to poor quality and uneven quality that could affect any of us. So I think these issues need to be addressed as part of comprehensive healthcare reform, if you will. But then, of course, there are also issues that are particular to communities of color, language access issues, vitally important that we address some of these concerns, issues of trying to address the cultural needs of various populations, vitally important that we address them. The question of whether these issues are addressed politically as part of a larger package, of course, we need our leadership to help determine that. But I'm very concerned that we not see these issues as being separate issues for those folks over there. These are issues that we must all grapple with. They ultimately affect all of us. And importantly, we got to look at our demographics in the United States. By mid-century, about 1 in 2 people who live in the United States will be a person of color. Stunning demographic changes. Our healthcare systems need to be able to keep up with these changes. So very, very soon, it's not going to be an issue of those folk of color. it's going to be all of us, and folk of color will be the majority very soon, so we need to be prepared to deal with these demographic changes.
So we're going to move into both some leadership issues, which you've just touched on, as well, and we're going to talk a bit more when we get the Congresswoman back on the line here about some of what's being done in Congress and on the Hill. But before we do that, I mean, clearly this conversation is happening at a time, as I mentioned in the introduction, where we have a serious economic crisis. And just last week, the Labor Department announced that over 530,000 jobs were lost in just the month of November alone, which is our largest decrease since, you know, 1974. So what do we think this means for our ability first to do major health reform, but also for initiatives that might be targeted at health disparities?
Well, I'll start simply by saying that, you know, this economic downturn, I think we need to understand that this has hurt every American, but disproportionately hurts people of color. And when we look at the relationship between health and wealth, health and income, we need to be very, very concerned that this current downturn is going to portend deeper health gaps for many populations, particularly for those populations that have been historically and in the contemporary context have suffered from inequality, marginalization. These are folks who haven't fully been able to participate in the American dream. So looking at that, and when we look at these numbers in terms of unemployment, when we look at the foreclosure crisis, some estimates indicate that the home foreclosure crisis has been the single biggest blow to Black and Latino wealth in the history of this country. It's going to have tremendous implications for the health status of these populations. We're going to see this very, very soon if we're not seeing it already. So I think that the first thing that we need to recognize is that this downturn is hurting everybody. We're going to see health consequences for many Americans. Disproportionately, it's going to hurt people of color. We're going to see wider health gaps. So I see a great, great urgency as part of this stimulus recovery package to consider the needs of communities of color, address these issues within the stimulus. I think it's going to be very important that we think about the health consequences of our decisions around jobs, of our decisions around infrastructure. The president-elect has made a big emphasis on rebuilding the infrastructure and transportation. Let's think about how we use these programs to also improve the health status of people of color. And even simple things like helping people to stay in their homes is going to be very important. I realize that many of these things fall outside of the health realm, but what I'm suggesting is that we need to put a health lens on our efforts to recover the economy.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk, I mean, you mentioned the infrastructure, and you've also mentioned the infrastructure, and what does this economic downturn mean for the ability of the healthcare infrastructure to treat the needs of the population?
I mean, this is, obviously, we think we're witnessing something truly devastating across essentially all sectors of our economy, and that is affecting the not-for-profit institutions, is affecting universities, and it's certainly affecting the safety net system. And I think, you know, again, you know, I think eventually Brian and I will find something we disagree about, but if it hasn't happened, hopefully our program will go on long enough for that to happen. But it is, you know, to the extent that we can prioritize around sort of the critical effects of the economic downturn around health, I do agree that it will pay large dividends to us. And certainly job stimulus and things like that are vitally important for the recovery prospects. But meanwhile, there are going to be people who are seriously hurt in a way that's somewhat irretrievable. And if you look at the general shift in federal programs and also sort of state-administered programs through both contractors and that are administered by state governments, there's been a gradual shift on the healthcare front towards cost sharing, towards co-insurance, towards co-payments, towards other sort of simple and relatively small hurdle financial obstacles that prevent people from, let's say, engaging in good chronic disease management through use of routine therapies that control, let's say, blood sugar or their high blood pressure or something like that. And those layers of cost barriers are placed there to largely because of something called moral hazard, which is something that we can all take different views on. But nevertheless, it's an area where relatively trivial dollar amounts could potentially translate into people not getting medications that we ultimately incur large healthcare costs for. Many of these medications are not only cost effective, but cost savings. And certainly, if you think about sort of the potential worker productivity issues, and in these poorer communities, particularly where the prevalence of these diseases are larger, the sort of net effect on the neighborhoods of lost work and greater comorbid illness burden within a community are very serious long-term problems. So that's a long way of saying a point that I suspect we'll both come back to a number of times, that as we think about this stimulus package, we should be thinking again about the places where small economic sort of fluctuations, in this case we're looking potentially at a huge economic fluctuation, but even those small ones could really sort of switch people from a place where they're kind of status quo and doing okay and managing their illnesses and other things to a place where it's desperation. And we start to lose ground that we cannot retrieve either at the individual level or at the sort of neighborhood or small community level. And that would be something that we know about today and is conceivably avoidable. And any funds that go to support that go right through the financial system just the way we would intend them to anyway.
It's also true that as we look at this current downturn, state and local health departments are less able to meet the needs of their communities. Our healthcare safety net, already frayed, is going to be tremendously challenged by the health consequences of this economic downturn. My fear is that there's going to be a huge need that's going to be very, very difficult to meet unless we prioritize investments in the healthcare infrastructure, in the public healthcare infrastructure. But I think this is also a great opportunity to finally come back to something that I think there is broad bipartisan support for, which is robust prevention. We need to be thinking very seriously right now about a prevention effort that is comprehensive, community-based, and that it addresses conditions in communities that make us sick in the first place. The Prevention Institute recently did a study showing that an investment of about $10 per year per person annually will reap tremendous benefits and will save us within 5 years about $16 billion in healthcare costs. So I think we ought to be thinking about some of these strategies now before things get much, much worse, so that we can both relieve the burden on our healthcare systems and also try to mitigate some of the consequences of this downturn for health.
Okay. So, you know, thinking about strategies, you mentioned the stimulus package, and we're talking about sort of health reform, and so kind of systematically going through our components of who's going to be involved in this and starting sort of at the top with our new president-elect. And this is, you know, kind of a question of what will we like, but what might we actually expect to see? And so what do you think that it means to have sort of a president-elect Obama in here, and what we might expect to see in terms of policies or initiatives that he might be putting forward regarding disparities? And I think specifically we've had a couple of questions about HIV, and we know that, you know, when he was candidate Obama, he had mentioned having a domestic plan for addressing health disparities in HIV and specifically for communities of color, but a larger plan focused on HIV. So things like that, what else might we expect to see from him?
What excites me about the president-elect's vision is that he sees the connection among many different issues. He understands that what happens in housing, education, transportation also has a relationship to health. So not only did the president-elect put forward a plan for addressing cost coverage quality, but he also has a plan specifically around disparities. And as you mentioned, he focuses quite a bit on HIV. So taking this further, I think what we see in the president-elect is a man who understands the interrelationships among policy decisions that are made in different sectors. Taking HIV, for example, one of the issues that we have to attend to is criminal justice policy. A lot of people think HIV is simply a question of individual risk behavior, people engaging in risk behaviors, and then you know, failing to get tested, failing to avail themselves of treatment services. It's a much more complicated problem than that. And I believe our problem begins with policies such as criminal justice policies that warehouse and incarcerate whole segments of populations. It has a tremendous impact on even folks who are not incarcerated, as we've seen. We've seen HIV rates increasing among women of color dramatically. There are many segments of our population where the epidemic is not slowing, and so we have to be very concerned about and think about how our policies in criminal justice, for example, which I think is hugely implicated in the HIV crisis. We need to think about how these strategies are not working to keep the public safer and to keep us healthier. So I hope that the president-elect and the Congress take bold steps to think about how these various sectors connect back to health, in particular with HIV, criminal justice, but then looking at other sectors, particularly for disparities. I think that it's exciting to see, for example, that the president-elect in 2006, along with Representative Solis, and hopefully she can speak to this a bit later, introduced what's called the Healthy Places Act, a very, very important act that acknowledges the importance of social, community, and economic conditions in contributing to health disparities. They call for greater use of health impact assessments to understand how policies in a range of sectors influence health. They call for grants from the federal government to help local jurisdictions to improve land use, to improve the built environment and the physical infrastructure, to create incentives for healthy foods to be available in communities. These are very, very important strategies that I hope the president puts squarely on the table early on as part of our thinking about a broader health reform package.
To build on that, I think, you know, in the near term, there's a couple of issues that have been challenging the disparities area, if you will, over the last several years. One, which I'm very optimistic about, is measurement. I think that, you know, we should be very optimistic that the new administration, the new Congress, is very comfortable with the notion that we need to be adequately capturing race and ethnicity data in all healthcare settings in a reproducible way using standardized formats, and so that we can move forward, and that would include the private insurance space, hopefully, so we can move forward to make sure that whatever we do, we can measure. I have to say that the measurement exercise to date has led to really disappointing results, because as we look more carefully and more regularly through things like ARC's National Health Disparities Report at how we're doing lousy. And so that level of knowledge in and of itself doesn't help anyone, but it certainly does help to guide programs and to provide rapid feedback for them. And I think so that's one thing I'm confident we'll sort of put to rest, if you will, is any, hopefully, any conflicts around that. I do agree, you know, on the HIV front, I haven't gotten over my deep frustration over what appears to me a widening chasm in new infection rates between whites and people of color, particularly that I think the rate is now 10 times the new infection rate amongst African Americans as it is for whites. And, you know, certainly the literature is rife with documenting that educational efforts and community-based efforts do decrease infection rates. I'm not that optimistic that mandatory testing in a care setting is going to reduce those infection rates meaningfully, because one of the key disconnects is the absence of appropriate care settings or absence of routine care settings for, particularly for African Americans. It affects other groups like Hispanics somewhat less. And so I worry on the HIV front. I don't want to seem pessimistic. I think awareness in this case, it will drive, hopefully, serious change. But I worry if the largest problem right now we have with HIV is actually new infections, although we have downstream management issues that are very serious. I mean, even things like pneumocystis prophylaxis, which I learned about in medical school a long time ago, should be an established fact. We're south of 90% in the carefully selected AIDS clinics that participate in ARC's quality report. We're still south of 90% on that. But, you know, those are sort of rarefied air. If we try to push through HIV transmission prevention measures through our healthcare system, it will leave out the people we most want to reach. And that is thematic around a number of issues that I think we are both worried about, and I think everyone in this field is worried about. If you take prevention, if you take health IT, if you take any of these interventions that are fundamentally channeled through our provider network, through active physicians, through our hospital systems, then those people who are somewhat separated from those systems will get the lowest dose of the intervention, and they are exactly the people we most need to reach. And so it's easy to criticize that action. The hard thing is saying what we should do. And I think that one of the things that work from ARC and Stanford and a lot of communities working in diabetes has shown is that if you try to segment the country or a state that you care about, and you try and become granular, and you try and find the pockets where key chronic illnesses, which consume most of our healthcare dollars and account for most of our lost days of work, therefore disability, unemployment, and all sorts of other sort of economic drags. If you try to locate places where there's high concentrations of somewhat preventable events, you can find them. You can engage with communities and local providers and alter their natural history. And there's some really nice examples of this happening in diabetes. If you look at the real, like the micro communities of renal dialysis centers, which are sort of little totalitarian empires, if you will, I mean, unbelievable the progress we are making there, and we've essentially eliminated important disparities in dialysis between blacks and whites, who are the groups that are most studied. So I think one of the challenges we're going to have, as I mentioned, just to sort of recap, is making sure that we put our interventions through the system in a way that reaches the people who are furthest out. One of the opportunities we have is to try and localize as much as possible those strategies to try and affect sort of the greatest denominator of people per dollar spent.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned data collection, and data is something that comes up in several of the sort of reform plans that we're seeing coming forth, Senator Baucus's plan, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But one of the questions that we had that came in was said that, you know, routine public health surveillance activities conducted by local and state health departments provide important information on health and well-being of Americans. However, across the federal agencies to which these data are reported, the Office of Management and Budget Standards for classification on race and ethnicity released over a decade ago are still not being used consistently. So, to, you know, what extent does this affect our ability to actually be able to describe disparities as well as address issues when we're not quite sure what's going on? Or do we know what's going on?
It's not an ideal situation. It would be nice if all metrics worked the same across platforms and the OMB standards. I think I don't consider myself an expert. I would be comfortable if they were consistently used. But, you know, it neither keeps us from being able to describe disparities, as you can see from the National Disparities Report and lots of peer-reviewed articles. We have no problem finding them. You just have to look, essentially. But certainly, as you know, federal programs and increasingly under a proactive government strategies, be it pay-for-performance or any other financial strategy that triggers off of, let's say, measurement of disparities or a reduction or elimination of them or anything else, we're going to have to all play by the same rule book just for administrative purposes. So, you know, we will need to do, if we're going to take seriously tying money, resources, or anything else, which is either the presence of disparities or acting upon them, we are going to need a standardized data collection approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's very frustrating to see that data are not being routinely collected and reported. I'd like to see these data collected and publicly reported, but it has to be done in a consistent manner. Clearly, the OMB guidelines are the standard. I would love to see financial incentives for institutions to collect data. There are some infrastructure issues. The health IT movement offers a wonderful opportunity to have meaningful race, ethnicity, and primary language data fields. And we need to have these routinely collected. But I think that there are still a lot of systems, particularly small practice settings, individual providers struggling with the appropriate systems to collect and capture data. Certainly local and state health departments have many varying approaches, as the questioner pointed out. But when you think about where we need to be, we're not even with the OMB guidelines, that's not even where we need to be. I look at a state like Massachusetts, which has got ethnicity fields for 30-some different ethnicities, nationalities that can be rolled up to the OMB standards. That's where we need to be eventually, because we have far too complex, too diverse a population to fit people neatly into these boxes. So we need to even get to our basic starting point of data to be able to fully understand where and under what circumstances disparities occur. Once we get there, my concern is that we have a much longer way to go to get to the point where we fully understand the diversity of the U.S. population. So I think that we need to get much more serious about carrots as well as some sticks, if necessary, to get the appropriate data collection that we need.
And that's great. I actually get to disagree with Brian.
Okay.
Okay.
Hi, this is Congresswoman Solis. I'm on the line, and I apologize for being late, but we have a caucus meeting that's ongoing right now in our house.
Not a problem. Welcome. I'm glad you're able to join us.
Yes, for a few minutes anyway.
I'll tell you later.
Okay. We were just talking about data collection in the use of racial and ethnic disparities to actually monitor what's going on, and Dr. Smedley was just mentioning that we should have some carrots and some sticks. But before we keep going with this, I actually want to go back and ask the Congresswoman, now that we have you on the line, one of the things that we have discussed is issues of what we might expect to see from a President-elect Obama. And as someone who's in the House who's worked very hard on these issues, I'd like to ask your opinion of what we might expect to see from the Congress in the coming session.
Well, I think we're in a very good position right now. President-elect Obama, as you know, has been a longtime supporter of some of these reforms that you all are talking about, in particular health care disparities. And he has also been a co-sponsor of legislation on the Senate side to help address the issues of health care inequality that exists. So I know that he has a very strong standing on this issue, and I'm hopeful that when we come into the new session in January that we will be reintroducing our version of the bill on our side, and I'm certain that the Senate will do the same. And then the two bills will have to become married. Ours is a little bit more comprehensive, I think, in nature, but I think that those things could be worked out, and certainly data collection is very important, creating incentives to bring people from these various communities to be attracted to the healthcare profession is so very important as well. So if we're talking about restructuring and data collection, those are all important things, but also trying to combat some of the chronic illnesses that have not been attended to in any, I think, concerted effort. It's been a patch, you know, kind of a piecemeal approach that I don't think has really served the public well and the taxpayers. So I'm hopeful that we can get this off the ground. We're going to need a lot of support. As you know, right now our legislation has about 100 co-sponsors and 300 community-based groups that are behind it. We've had the support of MCLR, SCIU, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, and within our own House of Representatives, our leaders have put their name on the legislation, with the exception of the Speaker, who doesn't normally do that. But that doesn't mean that she's not supportive. She is, in my opinion, about 150% supportive.
And Congresswoman Solis, if I could, you know, the president-elect has definitely made a case that he's going to help move health reform. And do you see that the disparities bill, such as the H.R. 3014 that you have introduced, or your Healthy Places Act, which he also, you know, introduced on the Senate side, do you see those moving in tandem, or do you see that becoming part of a larger health reform
bill? I would think just by way of trying to get things expedited more quickly, since we already know the structure and format of where we want to go, these could easily complement what bigger package the President-elect Obama would like to see happen. And I think it fits in very comfortably. I know we've been working with his staff in the past, this past legislative year, and I think we're somewhat in sync here. Now, the challenge for us is going to be, where do we get the money, the funding, and then making those reforms and how they'll be implemented. But I think that overall there'll be a lot more interest on this issue, and we've been working so hard, the Tri-Caucus, as you know, the Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, and the Asian Pacific Caucus, in trying to bring about pressure from our own House to make sure that we have these discussions here in our committees. And thank goodness that just this past year here, we were able to have two hearings, one in Ways and Means that Pete Stark called, and then one in our subcommittee on health with the help of Chairman Frank Pallone. So I'm hopeful that we can start off on a good foot here and begin to address the real issues as you described them, that we don't have all the data and information regarding racial minorities and language accessibility to these services, which is paramount to me, because so many people still in the, for example, immigrant communities, whether it's Hispanic, Indonesian, Russian, things get lost in the translation if you don't have appropriate individuals that can actually decipher and give adequate and culturally competent information to patients. We still find ourselves where we have a grandmother or parent being accompanied by a six-year-old child who may know some English, and that six-year-old is then asked to interpret what diagnosis or treatment needs to be given, and that is not appropriate. That, to me, is morally wrong.
Okay. And I'm going to come back to you in a minute, Congresswoman Solis, but I wanted to, as we're sort of moving down, sort of stepping through what the president-elect might do and what Congress might do, our next level is to sort of look at, you know, the federal agencies. And currently, the president-elect has a team out doing reviews of all of the agencies. And so, you know, Dr. Bach, as someone who was in CMS and knows firsthand what it's like working there, what are some of the levers that you think we could use more effectively in any of the agencies, or if you want to speak specifically to CMS, that we could use to address disparities?
Well, I think, you know, my portfolio, if you will, included CMS and then also FDA and NIH. So let me comment on all three quickly. The NIH Revitalization Act of 93 required that clinical research that was done looked adequately at groups of minority patients and other subgroups by sex, for example, to make sure that main effects of interventions translated to minority groups. I think that policy was unworkable from the get-go because of statistical considerations. And so I think one of the reforms that could be done, and it probably could be done at a regulatory level, is that there could be far better guidance from NIH as to which groups, what settings, what kind of clinical trials were highly amenable to studying subgroups of patients by, let's say, race or ethnicity or sex. And that should be based upon a confluence of sort of the prior probabilities or the likelihoods that different racial or ethnic groups do in fact respond differently or do experience different toxicity profiles. And when that is, and appropriate sort of levels of funding and recruitment strategies. And so trials should not be, if you will, hamstrung by a need to recruit groups, numbers of patients of minority background that they cannot, but neither should they be allowed to sort of go along merrily when they could conceivably or somewhat comfortably study these questions and are not. So, you know, that would be sort of the blanket concern about NIH. Within some of the NIH institutes, there's a fair amount of center funding that goes on, NCI being the primary one. I actually work at an NCI-designated cancer center. But I think that this funding, although in spirit is tied to community service that occurring from these centers, that too has not been pursued, I think, as aggressively as it could be. And to pursue it, again, requires the same sort of trade-off between asking centers to do what is feasible and getting them to do what is feasible. And right now, we ask them to do things that are not feasible, and therefore they're not penalized for failing. And so I think those are two things I think are important from a sort of research and care delivery through the research side. The FDA, I'd say the primary issue has to do with adverse event monitoring, I think, in terms of minorities. They obviously entitle and drive a lot of clinical research as well. But I think in terms of adverse event monitoring, they, through Sentinel and other projects like that, they need to actively work to help gather health claims data, particularly from institutions that don't traditionally have electronic health records and health IT infrastructure, and should drive an agenda around careful monitoring of patients over time within care settings. Which brings me to CMS. One of the greatest problems, and CMS is obviously through payment policy able to drive macro level changes, but CMS's entire payment system is based on the notion that if you're a willing provider and you have a tax ID number, you can deliver services to any Medicare beneficiary when you want, when they want, whether or not you know them, whether or not you don't know them, follow them or not. And other than things like malpractice and coverage, there's very little constraining either providers or patients from sort of, some people would characterize as free movement, I would characterize as chaos. So to the extent that adverse event monitoring at the FDA level and longitudinal follow-up of patients within care settings, the FDA label is important, it's 10 times more important within the agency. And so to the extent that we can move towards a patient-centeredness, patient-centered home model, actually somewhat closed systems, which I know is politically anathema to most people, but sort of tightly constrained care settings between coordinated providers for groups of patients over time, hopefully tied into electronic health records, we could actually create care communities for patients that are, you know, geographically restricted appropriately, or not restricted, but geographically focused. And so, you know, as I look at those three agencies, obviously many other agencies, but those, I think those are important sort of give takes, right, between where we are today, which I would characterize as an overexpensive failing in terms of our delivery to underserved populations and populations in general, to one that really does integrate sort of an ongoing accumulation of knowledge, with an improvement in care delivery.
Okay.
And that'll be the first 100 days.
And the first 100 days, right. And so one of the things, you know, we've talked a bit about social determinants, and I just got a question handed here again about the social determinants. And so as we're keeping this focus on levers that might be used, and I wanted to ask Brian and also the Congresswoman, what do you see as our ability to sort of work across agencies? So there are intra-agency within HHS, there's a lot going on, but our ability to connect HHS to some of these other departments to try and address the social determinants of health in particular. And so I wanted to see, sort of, Brian, what are your thoughts on what we might be able to do?
Sure.
What the Congresswoman specifically, now that we have her on the phone, could do.
Absolutely. Well, I'll be short so the Congresswoman can respond. There's several things that we need to do. Interagency, interdepartmental coordination is key because, as I alluded to earlier, education policy is health policy, housing policy, transportation policy. These are health policies. They have health impacts. The Surgeon General ought to be able to convene and coordinate activity across departments to better link these activities. And we need intergovernmental work as well, federal, state, local collaboration and cooperation. I think we need the same interdepartmental, interagency cooperation at state and local levels as well. I also wanted to speak to the issue of what are federal agencies doing well and what needs to be improved. There's a lot that federal agencies are doing that has tremendous potential to reduce health disparities. CDC's racial and ethnic approaches to community health, the REACH programs, tremendously effective, but yet they have suffered from inadequate funding. We ought to be expanding this program dramatically because the research evidence shows that they are effective. They're developing many innovative models, community-focused efforts that help us to understand and better intervene at the community level, which is where we need to most cost-effectively intervene. Other programs are effective. Congresswoman Solis mentioned the provider workforce. We have tremendous provider workforce challenges. We need more primary care physicians. We need greater diversity in our healthcare workforce. But yet federal programs, particularly the Title VII health professions programs, have suffered again from inadequate funding. I really hope that this Congress and the new administration seriously considers expanding these programs so that we have a provider workforce that reflects the diversity of our population and provides incentives to stimulate more providers going into primary care and putting these providers in communities where they're most needed, because we suffer from a tremendous problem of maldistribution. We've got a relative glut of providers in wealthy communities, a relative dearth of providers in communities where they're needed most. I also just wanted to say a word briefly about NIH as well, because I agree with Peter's assessment. There are tremendous challenges in terms of building a robust disparities research agenda. Now, the National Center for Minority Health and Health Disparities, under the leadership of John Ruffin, has done a tremendous amount of work. They've got an important conference coming up next week, a very, very exciting event that I think will help us to further the field. But when we look at NIH, there are several problems. One is the culture of orientation toward bench science. We cannot solve health disparities by looking through a microscope. We've got to turn that microscope around, focus on structures in society and conditions in communities that are the fundamental drivers of health disparities. And I think that the National Center gets that and is beginning to shape a research agenda in that direction. Part of the problem at NIH is that we have so many disease and organ and tissue-based systems, institutes, that keep us focused on particular disease systems. We need to be focused on the fundamental drivers of health disparities. I would love to see a national prevention institute, for example, that might capture some of these disease-by-disease resources and focus them on fundamental determinants of disease so that we can appropriately intervene.
And Congresswoman Solis, what about that in terms of our ability to sort of reshift our framing of going from a disease-based model to looking more sort of upstream at some of these causes with the prevention and also looking at those social determinants? Is that something that you think that the Congress would be able to address? And if so, how might that happen?
I think, initially my gut would say, yes, we should be doing that. But like anything else, it's hard to get all members of Congress to agree on a description of how you deal with this problem. Some in our own caucus would like to see us just, as you know, address the whole issue of cancer. Mm-hmm. But when you find that there are subgroups that have higher incidence, breast cancer amongst Asian women and amongst Latinas, they go, undetected for many years because they don't have access to mammograms or for prevention of cervical cancer, I would think that we would want to prioritize those populations that have a higher incidence of the disease so we can cut back and provide prevention. So in the long run, we can save some money here. So it does make a lot of sense that even in those research areas that we maybe carve out some areas where we can find similarities amongst ethnic groups or groups that are heavily impacted because of where of socioeconomic factors, where they live, where they work, the air they breathe. If they live around a surrounding area that has a number of negative air emissions, contaminants in the air, the water, blah, blah, blah. I mean, things like that I think are very, very important that we continue to have the research ongoing. And I think there are some people that are now doing that. I know I've met with some folks from USC and UCLA, and they're looking at those factors in our environment that are creating this disparate disparity that we see happening in the Latino community. If you find, for example, a local elementary school next to a freeway exit, chances are there are going to be higher rates of asthma. And if there is no playground, if it's all concrete, no grass, no facilities for physical activity, there's chances are there's going to be high obesity and diabetes too. So there are certain things I think we already know, but I do think there has to be a more focused approach systematically and with, as someone said earlier, intergovernmental cooperation. I really do think that if we were talking to each other, agency with agency, we could cut through a lot of red tape and circumvent the process and get to the immediate problem and come up with solutions. So I'm a big advocate for that. And I just want to mention that it is imperative that we get our educational institutions involved in helping us identify potential candidates to work in the health field arena. Right now we have less than 3% of Hispanics who are currently serving as U.S. physicians in the entire country. I mean, you have in a district like mine, maybe, in say a couple of precincts, maybe, no, not even precincts, maybe one doctor to maybe four or 5,000 patients. That's unrealistic. Mm-hmm. Unrealistic. And it's no wonder that we have these chronic illnesses and problems. I do want to mention also that we do need to look at non-traditional ways of reaching these communities that speak a different language or have different cultural barriers that they face. And one project or a program that I know of that has been demonstrated to work along the border and other parts of the country is known as the Prometoras. Mm-hmm. These are community workers who can be trained in any specific area, whether it's rural America, southeast part of the country, or even in the southwest, where you find individuals who can help serve as kind of navigators. Mm-hmm. And help provide and enlist support and empower the community to better understand what certain techniques they can use, referral to services, how to sign up for the SCHIP program, how to sign up for the Medicaid, or how to go first upon, say, an illness that comes up, going to a public clinic as opposed to going to the emergency trauma center.
Right.
And having to wait 8 hours to be seen.
And one of the things, I mean, we've received several questions related to disparities that are taking place in communities. We've all mentioned communities now and the differences and, you know, all problems are sort of local. The problems of one community are different from another community. And what can we do sort of at the Congress, also with the agencies? Brian, you mentioned the REACH program and expanding that. But what else can we do, people want to know, to help those communities address these issues? So sort of starting with you, Dr. Bach, as someone who is in the clinic and in the community working with patients, what do you see as some of your biggest needs?
Well, I'm not the perfect person to ask in terms of my on-the-ground experience by virtue of where I practice, but the Congresswoman did note the low concentration of physicians in areas, in communities of color, in relatively impoverished communities. She is correct. That's been empirically documented. And there's no question, if you think about just the physician workforce for a second, and Brian mentioned that, you know, we have this sort of twin problem of not enough primary care physicians and too much concentration of physicians in some areas. Most physicians in the United States are practicing in relatively small numbers by themselves or with one other doc. They are for-profit entities. And they are going to, on average, practice in places where they can achieve a higher reimbursement rate. Or that's either through self-pay patients in some cases, or at least through richer managed care contracts. And these Medicare pay rates are mostly fixed. The consequence is, and I was involved in a study that documented this very clearly, that people of color, African Americans in the case of our study, go to docs who have large numbers of uninsured patients, or who pay essentially nothing, and large numbers of Medicaid-covered patients. And the consequence is that the financial infrastructure of their practice is poorer, and they're less able to provide the sort of services that doctors who have better financial infrastructure can provide, never mind that it's financially unattractive to practice in those communities, and so they don't flock there. And so people end up there either because they can't get higher pay jobs in higher paying places, so you end up with sort of the lower end of the distribution of quality, or people end up there because they're there to serve a higher purpose. And I think there are many people like that who've gone to communities either from which they've derived or feel an allegiance to culturally, and that's great, but it shouldn't be like that. The fact that we have broad variations in payment rates for effectively the same service causes two problems. One is it commoditizes medicine, and the other is it makes it a monopoly, all at the same time. It's a miracle of our bizarre healthcare system, and we should have neither of those things. We should have doctors of high quality, and they should be paid based on the quality of the services they provide, irrespective of the recipient of those services. There are some mechanisms in Medicare and Medicaid to shift the financial incentives into poorer communities. We do it in the hospital level through things like the DSH payment. We do it in rural places through things like the HPSA or HPSA or health professional shortage area payment. But we don't do it in physician offices. But we could. Mm-hmm. And it would be really logical if you look at the places where the complexity of chronic disease is the highest, tends to be poor communities, and the relative proportion of doctors is the lowest, tends to be poor communities. You can see the sort of inherent lack of logic of that structure. And we can either use financial incentives or heavier structural setups, certificate of need and other things like that, to shift this balance. But it won't happen through market forces, because the market is, as I described, one that draws the doctors to the wealthier places where the reimbursement rates are higher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what Peter just said is one of the key problems with health care disparities, separate and unequal care. And this is not to stigmatize those providers working in underserved communities, working under difficult circumstances, many of whom, as Peter pointed out, are very dedicated to serving in these communities. So we need to correct that. That is absolutely unacceptable, or it ought to be unacceptable in this country. The federal government can show leadership in a number of other areas. Look at what some states are doing. State of Pennsylvania, recognizing that there are some communities that are food deserts, where the retail food environment is extremely poor, characterized by a glut of fast food outlets, very few grocery stores, major grocery chains with low-cost fresh fruits and vegetables. They have set up a healthy food initiative that provides incentives for major grocery chains to set up shop in communities that are often lower income, inner city communities, don't have access to appropriate sources of nutrition. Federal government can scale up programs like that. Let's also look at what we're doing as part of the stimulus package, building infrastructure. Again, the great emphasis on transportation. Let's make transportation systems that are bicycle and pedestrian friendly. Let's ensure that we have mass transit that makes sense, that reduces air emissions, gets people to jobs where they need to be, and reduces associated problems with pollution and increases healthy activity. These are things that can be done as part and parcel of our stimulus package. So again, if we apply a health lens to the way that we're conducting this stimulus, it could have great benefits for reducing health disparities.
Mm-hmm. And Congresswoman Solis, we were talking here, you know, sort of about states and some of the issues. And are there plans to work with the states and help them through, particularly as they're struggling with the economic crisis? But, you know, Dr. Smiley just mentioned that Pennsylvania has some things, and United Healthcare just came out with their report articulating sort of where some of the states are struggling with health challenges and how they differ. Are there plans to sort of look at how we can help those states with their particular challenges, those that specifically are dealing with financial issues more so than others?
Well, I think that overall, given what we've seen over the last 2 months and the dire economic straits that we're in, that we know all of our states are suffering, and healthcare seems to be at the top of that, at the top of that list. And I know in my state of California, there is a great need to try to continue to keep the SCHIP program, the Healthy Families program, alive, so enrollment will continue, but they're almost at the point where they can't continue to enroll any more children, and that's really unfortunate. What is being proposed, I know, in our state is that there's an attempt to try to get private foundation dollars and other folks involved so that they might help to provide for that safety net until we can draw down some federal money. Right now, as you know, we're in transition, so I can't really tell you that, yes, it's all coming, it's on its way, because it's not. And we also have to look at how we then reauthorize that program as well, the SCHIP program. You know that there was a big barrier for the immigrant community there with the provision that does not allow legal permanent resident children to be enrolled in the program. There's a five-year ban. Well, when you think logically about that, if the child enters into, say, kindergarten, they're not going to see a physician for a long time. By that time, they can have major tooth decay, they can be misdiagnosed for other ailments, and maybe even put back in their grade level because maybe they have never been checked for their with an optometrist, or basic things that should be provided for every child. And I think that there is going to be, I think, a concerted effort to try to expand that program. And we're going to need everybody to be on the same page with us, because that is going to be a sacrifice, a monetary sacrifice. I do agree with the previous speakers that said that some of the private clinics will go out where they can get the biggest reimbursement. But I can tell you that we will also be very cautious in terms of how those programs are run, because we don't think that any percentage should be going for administrative services that are non-related to health. And I know that scares people, but to be honest, we're talking about covering people's lives, and it begins with our children.
Okay. And so a question I have for sort of all of you is, as we're moving forward and thinking about priorities, as we're coming to a close here, and what are our priorities, and if we were to assume that President-elect Obama is able to get some form of health reform passed where we can substantially increase the number of people who have coverage so that we have fewer people without coverage, what is our next priority?
I would start, again, with a robust community-based prevention agenda. And at the risk of sounding like a real estate agent, prevention, 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 and location, location, location. These are critically important determinants of health and health disparities. And I think, again, that if we're serious about an economic recovery that includes everybody, we've got to ensure that every American is healthy enough to be able to participate in this recovery. Again, research shows that when we invest in prevention, we reap the benefits. We save health care costs. People are healthier, better able to participate in the economy, greater productivity. Again, the Prevention Institute's research shows that when you invest a dollar in robust prevention efforts, you get back over $5.50 within 5 years for every dollar invested. So we ought to be thinking about a robust prevention strategy. We ought to be thinking about strategies that address social determinants, the built environment, economic conditions in communities, because these are the fundamental drivers of health disparities, and also have a powerful influence on health for everybody in this country.
Mm-hmm. Dr.
Brock? I get to disagree. I think, obviously I agree, it would be nice to do all those things, very much so, but I would take the exact opposite approach. Particularly in the near term, what we need is chronic disease management, and we need to target those who are the most ill, because they're the ones actually where you can demonstrate that not only through intervention can you do things that are cost-effective. Most things cost money. And I'm skeptical of the prevention statistics, but that's for a separate conversation. But you also can maintain sort of work levels. You can keep adults from becoming sick and therefore hindering their ability of their kids to become educated. And you can affect sort of the tail end of the distribution, which consumes a great deal of resources. Our money is going to on the healthcare side to the management of complications of chronic illness. If we could move slightly upstream, not to a population-based strategy that focuses on prevention of people around people who have no symptoms or signs of disease, but to that group who are highly, highly at risk, the diabetics who are mismanaged but don't have a lot of end-stage complications and the rest. If we could focus our energies there and we can identify those people using available national resources that we have through the disparities report and other sort of targeting methods, we can near-term affect both sort of productivity and sort of healthcare costs. And I think that it's targeted, which means it leaves out people. But it's targeted, which means each dollar spent really does drive a good benefit.
And Congresswoman, what would be your priority if we get coverage for the majority of Americans?
Well, I would tend to agree that prevention and information are just really essential to any healthcare reform that we undertake. And I say that because I've seen where thousands of, for example, women become infected with the HIV and AIDS virus and don't learn about it until it's full-blown because they've never gone to a primary care physician. They never thought they would be that anything like that would happen. So many in the Latino, African-American, and other immigrant communities will probably not see their doctor regularly because they either do not have access, coverage, or if it becomes a crisis, they end up in the trauma center. That's the highest form and costly health care. I think prevention is the way to go, information, and give these populations the ability to help self-treat themselves and understand what it is, what kind of disease they may be exposed to or that it's prevalent in the community. And I think that it's worth expending that money there. A dollar up front in this area can save $6 later down the line. And I do believe that we need to do more in terms of attracting physicians to stay in communities, not just in rural America where there are incentives, for example, in the HCOP program, where you have career migrant individuals that get involved in serving in rural areas. Well, the problem isn't just rural America. It's in urban America, in cities like mine, in East Los Angeles, in Baldwin Park, in El Monte, where you have an absence of physicians that understand culturally competent services to the population. And we need to somehow have a better loan forgiveness and repayment program for physicians as well as dentists.
Okay. And so to kind of close and bring it back, we have a new exciting time. Got a new president coming in and a new or larger Democratic majority-controlled Congress. And as we think about this, one of last year we had Dr. David Satcher on, and he said that, you know, really it's sort of leadership and putting this as a priority. And in the past, we have not made the elimination of health disparities a priority if you kind of look at our funding and things like that. Do you think we're going to do that in this coming administration?
I'll let you go first, Peter.
I hope so. And as I said at the top of the hour, I think it's very hard to forecast what the priorities will be. There's obviously a lot of pressing issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I also said I'm agnostic to whether or not we make eliminating disparities the focus or improving the quality of care to people who get the lowest quality of care as our first priority. To me, those are somewhat synonymous except for framing. And I wouldn't want to see us hampered by taking one view or one sort of framing of the issue versus another when the real urgency is about the lack of health care in these communities.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there needs to be a focus on those who are most at risk. These are communities, populations that have been historically marginalized but also face contemporary inequality of opportunity. So I think that this president gets that, president-elect rather, and that this is clearly going to be one of his priorities. There are enormous headaches, enormous challenges for this president-elect. But again, I think that that he recognizes that in order to fully bring about an economic recovery, we've got to attend to and prioritize interventions to those folks who historically have been left behind. We can't afford to leave them further behind.
Okay. So before we close, I would like to thank Representative Ilda Solis, Dr. Peter Bach, and Dr. Brian Smedley for joining me today, and I would like to thank you all for your questions. On our webpage, you will find resources on today's topics that may be useful to you in your research and in your work. Again, I'm Kara James of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.